Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Two companies are getting divorced. A country's GDP goes up by 25% in a single day. And advertisers are learning more about you. All that's on today's show from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdal. He's in Houston today for a live show we're doing around the country called How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Numbers. Today's Tuesday, the 30th of September, and it's great to have you with us. We start today with a corporate divorce story. eBay acquired PayPal about 12 years ago and built it into something that this year generated almost half of the company's revenue. Now the two are going their separate ways. Each, once again, will be a separate company. The CEO, John Donahoe, will step down, and both businesses, the idea at least, will be stronger in a landscape that's only becoming more crowded and competitive. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports on the breakup.
eBay and PayPal seemed pretty tight until last January, when an interloper started pushing them apart.
PayPal is a bit of a no-brainer.
Activist investor Carl Icahn. He quickly went from pushing to shoving, going after eBay's leadership.
I think he's either naive or just asleep at the switch here.
Icahn speaking to Bloomberg there. He lost that fight in the short term, but in the long term,
they have to grudgingly admit that he was right.
Paul Sweeney is senior media analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. PayPal wants to be the way everyone pays for everything, online and at the store. But so does Square, Softcar, Google for a while, and now Apple Pay. If PayPal has to consider eBay every time it makes a decision, it's going to get tied down.
The eBay folks and PayPal folks looked around the marketplace. They saw a market that continuing to change rapidly and continuing to get more competitive.
Proximity payments, that's paying for things using your phone or things like PayPal, are blowing up, says Brian Yeager, analyst at eMarketer.
This year, we expect proximity payments to reach $3.5 billion, and by the end of 2018, hitting a little more than $118 billion.
Even so, Yeager says that's a drop in the bucket when you consider how much money gets put on credit cards. Finally, eBay and PayPal just don't need each other like they used to. PayPal gets fewer and fewer new users from eBay, and eBay needs to free up cash to work on its own issues. There's competition from Amazon and maybe even Alibaba. The companies will split late next year, but they'll still be friends. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
This morning, the Federal Communications Commission, in a unanimous 5-0 vote, did away with what's known as the NFL blackout rule. The rule was around since 1975 and said if an NFL franchise didn't sell enough tickets to fill its stadium, a local TV channel was prohibited from airing that game. The NFL's initial reason for doing this was that people might not pay to see the team in person if they could watch the games for free on TV. Kenneth Shropshire directs the Wharton Sports Business Initiative at the University of Pennsylvania. Hey, Kenneth.
Hey, David.
I wanted to have you put this into some context for me. When you look at ticket sales on the one hand and these big TV contracts on the other, you know, which is more important to the NFL's bottom line?
Oh, by far now, media rights. You know, beyond TV, just all the bundled rights that come when you hear about these multi-billion dollar deals across sports. So those rights have very much surpassed the gate receipts, especially the thing about the NFL. You know, the NFL, you think a team has typically 8 home games. So the revenues from, you know, 8 times 60,000 people in a stadium at, you know, average ticket price of, you know, shy of $100. I mean, that number doesn't come close to the literally billions over a period of years that come in from media rights.
I gather that blackouts used to be a lot more common, and just reading in, saw that there were only 2 games in last season that were blacked out. What's changed? Why are so few games being blacked out?
Well, you know, if you're as old as me, you remember games were blacked out just by virtue of being a home game and you weren't going to see it. That you, if you wanted to, I grew up in L.A., if you wanted to see a local game in L.A., you had to drive outside the county to a bar or wherever else to watch on typical network TV. I mean, what's happening now is, a lot of it is the popularity of the sport. There's not this problem with selling the tickets that in terms of long-term planning, season ticket sales provide a tremendous base for a lot of these teams. And then the popularity of the game sells the rest of the tickets. It's also the case, too, that there's some flexibility in the rules now where the sales don't have to be 100%. Some situations, the sales can be as low as, I think, 85% of the actual capacity.
The argument the NFL was making throughout this process as the FCC was weighing this is that this could lead to more games going from free broadcast channels to pay channels on cable and satellite. Is that something that you would see happening anytime soon? I know a lot of these contracts go out, I think, like close to a decade in length. These are long-term contracts.
Right. Well, that certainly is what they're saying. So tough to know. I mean, the calculus of how much you want on cable and satellite versus, let's say, traditional television. Yeah, I mean, that's a calculus that's still being developed. So when the NFL says that, I think it's something to pay attention to. How important is that to continue to have access to those who don't have cable and satellite?
Kenneth Ropshire heads up the Wharton Sports Business Initiative at the University of Pennsylvania. Kenneth, thank you very much.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, that eBay news didn't do much for traders. Details when we do the numbers. Say the odds are pretty good you're in your car right now. Maybe you're leaving work, maybe you've just done some shopping. I'm just guessing. But with a smartphone, there's no longer a need to guess. That device can pinpoint your location and send that information to third parties. And with that, they can predict what you're going to do next. Sam Harnett has this report on how mobile location data is fundamentally changing how companies treat consumers.
People who buy used trucks rarely go to toy stores. Customers of KFC also frequent Home Depot, Nissan dealerships, and museums. Latinos are 43% less likely to shop at Whole Foods than the average person. Duncan McCall says he's determined all this by using people's smartphones to track where they are.
We use location as a foundation to essentially hang data from.
McCall is the CEO of PlaceIQ, a consumer behavior analytics company. It has drawn a new map of America, breaking the country down into 100-meter by 100-meter tiles. Inside each one, PlaceIQ notes where mobile users go and what they do.
We can see their journey across our map of the world, if you will, and now we can build very rich behavioral profiles. Shops in Walmart frequently, business travels, likes to go fine dining, works in these types of areas, etc., etc.
Since PlaceIQ can see where mobile users live, it can tie in traditionally gathered info like demographics, income, and even TV viewing habits.
So you can create a relationship between television viewing and physical behaviors in the world, such as store visitation.
So does McCall know exactly who you are? No. He says the data is currently anonymous. He doesn't want to know your identity. It's not the point. He just wants to predict what you'll do so other people can sell you things.
This data is going to change the way we market our product.
Sanjog Mishra is a professor of marketing at UCLA. He says digital data will affect things like how companies develop products and display them in stores. And they can now send personalized ads to individual users at an exact time and place.
I might advertise to you if I see that you are about to enter a supermarket, but I won't advertise to you while you're sitting at home.
Advertisers have been dreaming of individually tailored one-to-one marketing for years. To know exactly where you are is even better than they hoped.
But it has a very, very dark side.
Jeffrey Chester is from the Center for Digital Democracy. Collecting all this data is an invasion of privacy, he says. But there's another problem, one that's less obvious and even more alarming.
It raises the real threat of a new form of discrimination, of digital redlining.
He says data is already being used to determine how we are treated, whether we get perks like coupon codes and free shipping, or if we have to pay full price. In the future, who knows what it'll impact? Maybe credit card rates and loan accessibility.
Do we really want to live in a society where every movement we make, every decision we embrace is collected and analyzed, and decisions are made about it?
Well, we do give apps the right to track us. We can stop them by turning off the location services on our phones. But without that, some apps won't work. Duncan McCall from PlaceIQ says it's foolish to try to hide from tech.
The way you approach that is not by trying to play whack-a-mole with technology, because you'll always lose that because it will always evolve.
McCall and Chester at least agree on one thing. The only way to prevent discrimination and control our privacy is through regulation. in San Francisco. I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
Kenya's economy is 25% bigger today. The country changed how it calculates its GDP, adding new sectors of the economy, like real estate, that weren't there before. So now Kenya has become the fourth largest economy in sub-Saharan Africa. The BBC's Anne Soy is in Nairobi. She joins us now to tell us what it all means. Hi, Anne.
Hello.
So, Anne, why has Kenya decided to do this now?
Well, that's an interesting question. But we know that there are sectors that have emerged that were not considered in earlier computations of the gross domestic product, that is the value of goods and services. For instance, real estate, which is now a big player, contributing nearly a tenth to the economy. There's also really tremendous growth in the communications industry. As you know, Kenya is a pioneer in mobile money transfer, and it is estimated now that there are more mobile money accounts in this country than the adult population. So these are industries that were not considered in earlier computations, but it is now clear that they are contributing significantly to the economy.
So those sectors are now reflected in these figures, and all of a sudden Kenya is classified as a middle-income country. What does that actually mean?
There are levels that are set by the World Bank when the income per capita gets above a certain level, in this case more than $1,000, the country moves from a low-income country to a middle-income country.
What's the reaction to this been among people you've talked to?
It's really complicated because people are asking, so what does this mean? Because they don't really understand. It's sort of complex. But the idea is it doesn't mean that because Kenya was a low income country yesterday, the people now have more money in their pockets today. No, it doesn't translate that way. It just means that policymakers have more up-to-date statistics, which they can use now so that Kenya will be a more attractive investment destination. At the same time, it also means that the debt ratio seems lighter now. So the country has higher borrowing power when it needs to go borrow money from international lenders. It has a bigger voice now on the negotiating table.
You mentioned the growth in the communications and technology sectors. How has the Kenyan economy been doing overall? I saw that the poverty level is still around 50%, so that's still a problem.
That's right. Those other indicators remain the same. 4 out of every 10 Kenyans estimated to be living below the poverty line. Unemployment is still a big issue, estimated at about 12% of the youth. And one of the things that analysts feared as a result of this reclassification of Kenya's economy is that Kenya is then going to lose access to some of those concessional rates for loans from international lenders like the IMF, because now it has moved up the ladder. But I did speak to the representative of the IMF here today, and they said they're still looking at these other indicators, the poverty levels and the realities on the ground, and they will continue to extend those concessional rates to the country.
The BBC's Anne Soy joining us from Nairobi. Thank you very much, Anne.
You're welcome.
Coming up,
publicity and celebrity wrangling would probably be his greatest strength.
We'll introduce you to a guy who fought big oil and won, but lost his bearings along the way. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gave up 28 points, 0.1%, to close at 17,042. The NASDAQ fell 12 points, 0.25%, to end at 4,493. And the S&P 500 slipped 5 points, 0.25%, finishing at 1972. There is, as we've said before, new housing data every day. Today's report says the rise in home prices appears to be slowing, and that's good news if you're looking to buy. There's also news in the real estate business. News Corp, the newspaper publisher, is buying Move, the online real estate site that includes Move.com and Realtor.com. This sets up a head-to-head fight between Move and the flashier Zillow. For today, the score is Move. Shares up 37%. Zillow shares down at nearly 3%. European markets were mixed. France's CAC 40 gained 1.3%. Germany's DAX rose 0.5%. Britain's FTSE lost 0.3%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.5%. You are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for August. How many new cars are on the road? Automakers are scheduled to release sales figures for last month. And please pass the veggies. Tomorrow is World Vegetarian Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdal. Tomorrow is the anniversary of the launch of healthcare.gov. Since then, millions of Americans have enrolled in health insurance under the Affordable Care Act, and there have been plenty of changes behind the scenes. One of those is commercial insurers and the way they pay doctors and hospitals. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Dan Gorenstein reports.
One under-the-radar goal of Obamacare is to get doctors and hospitals to provide better care that costs less, a tall order when they get paid for pretty much every procedure or visit. It's called fee-for-service.
Evidence is very clear that if you pay for volume, you get volume, and if you stop doing that, you get less.
Harvard's Meredith Rosenthal says when providers are paid differently, it can reduce volume by as much as 20%. The question for insurers, the people who pay the docs and hospitals, is what payment method will curb unnecessary and sometimes harmful care. A new report from Catalyst for Payment Reform suggests insurers are dipping their toes into the water and offering financial incentives to meet certain benchmarks. It's called pay for performance.
In theory, it sounds so obvious that you should pay people more when they do their job better. It's just a no-brainer. The problem is that we're not using our brains to think it through.
Peter Ubel's a behavioral scientist at Duke. He says that financial incentive could be enough to make a physician see pneumonia, for example, when pneumonia doesn't exist.
There's always a bit of guesswork in most medical care. There's a lot of judgment involved. And so just remember that that judgment can therefore be affected.
The healthcare industry is experimenting with a number of payment reforms, which makes sense, says University of Pennsylvania's Rachel Warner.
We don't know exactly what doctors should be doing to provide high-quality care at a low cost. And it probably varies for every doctor and for every patient.
At this point, Warner says what's needed is more time to experiment with payment models to see what moves the needle. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Screen Wars is what we're calling our series about the future of TV and movies. Well, a big battle in those screen wars is scheduled to take place on August 28th, 2015, next year. That's when the just-announced sequel to Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon debuts, not only in theaters, but also on Netflix. That's a very big deal, especially for theaters. Stan Alcorn has the story.
In the age of Netflix and YouTube, movie theaters have been practically begging us to see their screens as special. You might have seen one of those action movie trailers where the action starts to shrink until it's just a tiny square projected in the middle of the big screen.
If you want action this big, you can't have a screen this small.
The exhibitors are right. It's a different experience.
Sam Craig directs the Entertainment Media and Technology program at NYU. He admits that streaming a movie over Netflix isn't the same as sitting in an IMAX cinema, but
you get a lot of people that have 60-inch HD screens and surround sound, and maybe they would just be as happy watching it at home.
For mainstream movies, they usually don't have that choice. Regal, AMC, and Cinemark, the chains that control most of the theaters in the U.S., insist on an exclusive 90-day window before movies can move to smaller screens on TV or online.
Anything that starts to erode or challenge the 90-day window could be a disaster for them.
By Craig's calculations, if just 10% stay home, that's more than $1 billion in lost ticket sales. But Rich Greenfield, media analyst at BTIG, thinks the power is shifting away from the theater's hands.
To get butts in seats, they got to show films. So ultimately, they won't have a choice.
If, that is, the movie studios can make enough online to make up for the lost ticket sales.
I think if the movie studios see the success of what Netflix and IMAX do, I think others will follow.
Now they just have to make sure the Crouching Tiger sequel is as big a hit as the original. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
You can check out the rest of our Screen Wars series on Marketplace.org, along with a post that's up today about how other streaming services are trying to compete with Netflix. Years ago, a court in Ecuador ordered Chevron to pay some $9 billion in damages For decades, a U.S. attorney named Stephen Donziger had fought for that award on behalf of indigenous Ecuadorians. Their land, he argued, had been polluted by drilling. But little's been done to remediate that remote corner of the Amazon, and none of that money has been collected, in large part because of how that lawyer, Stephen Donziger, behaved. Paul Barrett's written about this. His new book is called Law of the Jungle. It's good to have you with us.
Glad to be here. Hi, Dave.
I wonder if you could introduce us to the man at the center of your book, Stephen Donziger, this lawyer who, just a few years out of Harvard Law School, takes on this case. It is indeed the only civil case that he's done his entire career. How does he end up working with these indigenous peoples in Ecuador?
Extraordinary story. So Stephen Donziger has experience in Central America even before law school. He's gone down there to cover the Nicaraguan Civil War.
As
a reporter for UPI. He found that reporting, while exciting and romantic, didn't really put him centrally in the action. He wanted to be a protagonist. He wanted to be an actor, not an observer. Then he learns about this nascent lawsuit in Ecuador. Everything comes together. This fight is going to become his fight.
And it is for a number of decades.
That's right.
My immediate question was, who was bankrolling this? Who was bankrolling his involvement in it?
No, good question. At the outset, this was being bankrolled in a relatively conventional fashion. A plaintiff's law firm of long standing in Philadelphia signed on to cooperate on this case, and that law firm spent some $7 million on the case. But eventually, as happened with many of his colleagues, Donziger had a big falling out with the head man at Cohn, Swift & Graft, and they fell away. So he needed other forms of financing. Stephen Donziger was an extraordinary financier, an organizer of the financial resources necessary to move the case forward.
And an extraordinary publicist as well. He got a lot of public attention on this case.
You know, publicity and celebrity wrangling would probably be his greatest strength. The documentary filmmaker Joe Berlinger made a film called Crude, which debuted in 2009 at the Sundance Film Festival, with Robert Redford applauding in the audience, Sting and Trudy Styler on the dais saying to the elite audience, get your checkbooks out, you've got to support this lawsuit. An extraordinary series of achievements, which then became his undoing.
Yeah, about that, I mean, this movie shows him in Ecuador, yes, meeting with plaintiffs, the people whom he represents, but also doing all manner of things that ultimately, as you say, lead to his downfall.
Call them avant-garde legal tactics. He invited Berlinger and his film crew to follow him everywhere, including at his private meetings, including at lunches where he would hold forth on how corrupt the Ecuadorian judiciary was and how winning in Ecuador was all about pressure and making the judge feel that he might be killed if he ruled against the people and for the oil company. Chevron sees the released movie and sees that there are discrepancies. Chevron takes that to a federal judge and says, Judge, we want to see all the rest of the field tapes. From there, Chevron was able to persuade the same judge to force Donziger eventually to turn over all of his hard drives, all of his emails, and in there was the evidence of much worse behavior, bribery, coercion, submission of false scientific evidence.
You address this in the book. I mean, a much smaller judgment could have made strides to clean up this place.
Absolutely.
How much would it have cost, and what could have happened to clean it up?
Maybe the order of magnitude is tens of millions of dollars, $100 million, but right away this thing took off into the stratosphere. The order of magnitude became billions. Donziger framed the only villain as Texaco and then Chevron alone, completely obscuring the role of the Ecuadorian National Oil Company and the Ecuadorian government.
He's not in jail. What's he up to now? What's Steve Donziger
right.
up to?
He has a certain following. There are environmentalists who still are behind him, but many of the people who've worked most closely with him have abandoned him and have, in fact, accused him of fraud. And that includes some of his past financiers, some of his past co-counsel, some of his past scientific experts who have said, he tricked us and we disavow what we did in connection with this case.
Paul Barrett, a senior writer at Bloomberg Businessweek, is the author of Law of the Jungle. Paul, thank you very much.
It's been my great pleasure. Thanks, David.
We've got an excerpt of Paul Barrett's book, Law of the Jungle, up on our website. Check it out. It's at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note is about a movie that is, as they say, coming soon to a theater near you. That music doesn't provoke a Pavlovian response, sending you running for your old Game Boy. That is the old Tetris theme, and soon there will be a Tetris movie. The head of the company making that movie also made the Mortal Kombat movies, so he has some experience with this sort of thing. In case you're wondering how a game that's all about bricks will translate to the big screen, The head of the Tetris company, which owns the rights to the game that debuted 3 decades ago, says there's much more to Tetris than simply clearing lines. We have a story behind Tetris, the film's producer promises, adding it'll be a very big, epic sci-fi movie about bricks. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 28 points, 0.1%. The NASDAQ lost 12 points, 0.25%. And the S&P 500 slipped 5 points, 0.25%. Our special projects team is Nancy Fargali and Millie Jefferson. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Esch are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin, Shay Huffman, and Tony Wagner. I'm David Gura. Kai will be back in the host chair tomorrow. This is APM.